This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2005, the United States government oversaw the boom of an increasingly rare and valuable element. There's a national reserve set up to protect America's supply, and it's used in MRIs and nuclear reactors and cryogenic science, though you've probably seen it most recently at a birthday party. It is helium, and it is not here to stay. Rosie Chima wrote the article, The Increasing Scarcity of Helium, for Priceonomics, and joins us now to tell us why those Mylar birthday balloons may soon be a thing of the past. Rosie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you.
So when I think of helium, I do think of those Mylar balloons and the blimps that fly over ball games, but there are much more serious uses for it. What are some of them?
Well, a big one is its use as a coolant, because helium actually has a really low boiling point. When a liquid is kept at its boiling point, it never gets any hotter. It'll continue to boil and stay at that temperature forever. And so water always stays at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, so long as you keep it liquid. And helium actually stays at negative 452 degrees Fahrenheit, so long as you keep it liquid. So it's used to keep things cool that need to stay really, really cold. So it's used in arc welding, insulating superconductors in nuclear reactors, and then in cryogenics, which is a more obscure use.
And I guess one of the more common uses here is in MRI machines. How so?
That's right. So MRI machines have magnets in them that need to be kept cool. They use helium to insulate that.
How long have we been using helium?
We've been using helium for a little over a century. It was discovered in the late 19th century. And then in the early 1900s, we discovered that we could mine it, because the earliest helium was synthesized from radioactive minerals. But then we realized that we could extract it from natural gas, and that became a major American industry.
If we can extract it from natural gas, then why is there any fear that we'd run out? Is it considered a non-renewable resource?
Right. So helium is lighter than air. That's one of its selling points. And that means that once it's extracted, it just kind of floats away out of the atmosphere.
So you can only take out as much as you're going to use. So it's difficult to store.
It's definitely difficult to store. It's also very tiny. It's made out of two protons, right? It's one of the smallest atoms on the periodic table. So it can get out of most things. That's actually another one of its uses. It's used to detect leaks in things that need to be really, really well sealed.
There was a bit of a helium boom in the early 2000s, which did lead to concerns that we could run out of the supply within the next 100 years. How did helium become so undervalued?
That's actually a really interesting and pretty complicated story. When the extraction of helium from natural gas was discovered in the United States, the U.S. actually placed a lot of regulations on its export and started stockpiling it itself. I mean, it did have a lot of uses for the military and then in the space race. There were airborne aircraft carriers that were basically zeppelins or dirigibles. By the 90s, the helium stockpile still existed, except present-day politicians no longer valued it. And it had been kind of mismanaged, so it was in debt. And they started selling off all of the helium that they could. And the goal was to sell off all of it by 2015, which meant that they were selling it off for extremely cheaply, like way below market value.
So where does it come from now? Who's got the world's helium?
I think that we still do, although more mines are popping up elsewhere. I think there's one in Qatar, or at least it's being developed in Qatar, and another one in Algeria. And then the reserve we did not successfully sell off by 2015, and Congress has passed a law to push that deadline farther back, and also like try to bring the government price up closer to the market price.
So what was to happen in 2015?
In 2015, we were supposed to be done and the National Reserve would be shut down. And a lot of people were actually very worried about that because the National Reserve still had a lot of helium and it would have cut off one of the biggest supplies of helium in the U.S. or in the world, actually.
So, we see these party balloons absolutely everywhere. It certainly isn't being treated like a scarce resource. But aside from those spiking in price, what would be the consequence of a helium shortage?
The cost of science would go up tremendously. It's anywhere that helium's used. So, like, nuclear power for one, MRI machines and, like, medicine for another, a lot of the physical and natural sciences.
Any kind of attempts being made to replace it, you know, create some sort of synthetic coolant that would take its place?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of people experimenting with that. There's also, China's started to try to mine helium-3 from the moon. It's definitely a long-range plan.
Well, Rosie, thank you for telling us another thing to fear.
Yeah, as if we needed one.
Rosie Chima authored the article, The Increasing Scarcity of Helium for Priceonomics, and you'll find a link to read her article on our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. While helium is quickly becoming an endangered resource, the fact remains the kids will still be sucking on it at birthday parties, and Morgan Freeman and Jimmy Fallon will still have conversations while inhaling the element.
Do you ever want to go to space? I really shouldn't be doing this.
But why does it make us sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks? Joe Hansen is the host and writer behind PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart and joins us to talk about why helium makes our voices squeak. Joe, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the science behind this? Why does helium make our voice squeak?
So imagine like in a jazz band, you got a saxophone or a piano. They can play exactly the same note, like an A, and sound completely different. Musicians know that A is 440 hertz. It's a sound wave, cycles 440 times per second. But each instrument, in addition to that note, makes a bunch of other frequencies that we call overtones. And that's what gives each instrument its special sound. So our voices do the same thing, are full of overtones. When we suck in a big breath of helium, we change the speed of sound in our vocal cords because sound waves travel faster in lighter gases. And it shifts all those overtones to higher frequencies. And you end up sounding like Donald Duck.
Okay, I think I'm totally with you on this one. But inhaling a gas, that can't be very good for you, can it?
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend this, speaking from a science or medicine perspective. Maybe just look it up on YouTube.
Well, Jimmy Fallon certainly does it with a lot of his guests. Could he do any permanent damage to his voice using inhaling helium?
No, it reverses after a few seconds. You can actually do the same thing with heavier gases that are a little bit harder to find. Those are really fun videos to find, too.
Yeah, so what would they do? Would they make your voice richer and deeper?
You'd sound like Morgan Freeman. It would be great.
And this balloon is filled with an extremely dense gas called sulfur hexafluoride. Now, sulfur hexafluoride has a density which is 5 times greater than air.
Okay, and as you can tell, my voice gets really low. Oh, boy. Oh, I almost threw up on that one. So.
Well, Joe, thank you for explaining that.
Thanks for having me, and don't try this at home.
Joe is the host and writer of PBS Digital Studios' It's Okay to Be Smart. You can view loads of episodes at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us. Up next, we're going to hear about a group of scientists that is looking to make the periodic table of elements even larger by making elements of their own. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Elements are the building blocks of the universe as we know it. But there are some who are looking to push the frontiers of matter further than ever before by creating their own elements. Our conversation about the vanishing element of helium reminded us of an earlier interview with Rob Dunn, who wrote about the element hunters for National Geographic. So when prepping for this interview, I was talking with my colleagues thinking that the periodic table was done. Give us a little summary of the process of adding discoveries to the periodic table. How are they even decided?
Well, so it's interesting. So your intuition is right that the periodic table, in terms of the elements that we find around us, is done. But in the 1940s, scientists started to try to make elements that don't currently exist, in essence, smashing other elements together. And part of that endeavor is just to sort of see what science can do, maybe a little bit like Dr. Frankenstein did with his monster. The other interesting thing is that in the 1950s, it was predicted that maybe if you could make really, really heavy elements, that they might last a long time. And one of the things that defines the periodic table as we know it is that as you produce heavier and heavier elements, as you get up to toward 92, which is the end of the elements that we find outside, they get more and more fleeting. But this prediction suggested that maybe if you got really heavy elements, that they might last minutes or hours or days or maybe even thousands or millions of years. And if they did, it would actually change what we know about how every other element works, because it would mean that the insides of the elements are actually arranged in something like shells. And so what scientists wanted to do was to try to produce these really heavy elements, both to see if they could, but also to see if our understanding of the entire universe and the stuff out of which everything we love or hate is made is true.
Well, one of the ways that you draw us into this process is through one of these few people, a very driven, very interesting scientist named Yuri Oganessian, is what I'm guessing that you pronounce his name. He's working out of a lab in Dubna. This is a city north of Moscow. So how is he going about creating these new heavy elements, as you put it?
He started in on the story in around 1978. He figured out what might be a new way to make heavier and heavier elements, which was to take something like plutonium and to sling a sort of medium weight element like calcium at it. And so he imagined that if you could do this, you could make really heavy things, and you might make something as heavy as 114. And if you could do that, you could test this theory. And 114 came to be described as being on this island of stability. And so in 1978, he starts on this. And his first real headway is in some ways in 1998. And so all these years later, when he finally has everything together to try to produce 114, and he slams these atoms together at trillions of miles an hour, and when he does, he produces a single atom of 114. And as he does, the question becomes, how long does it last? Does it last longer than 113? And if it does, to him, that will mean that everything we thought about all of the elements was wrong, and in fact, the centers of the elements or the atoms are arranged in these sort of predictable ways. And in fact, 114 does last longer. And then he goes on to produce multiple versions of 114 and 113, 115, 116, 117, and 118, and explore this whole landscape. And so he's just this one guy, and it's all their lab really focuses on. And they've done it through the hardest years of recent Russian history. You know, they do it in this teeny town, and Oganessian could not be a more pleasant, affable guy. And so it's really an amazing situation.
And because you are writing for National Geographic, there are these fantastic photographs of the lab. It makes it look like this Cold War era, you know, frozen in time industrial lab in Dubna. Who's funding this work?
Originally, all this work was very contentious. That, you know, the Russians fought with the Americans for who was first, and the Germans fought with the Russians. But now these endeavors are so difficult that they're actually really international collaborations. And so the lab in Dubna is partially funded by the U.S., partially funded by Eastern Europeans, partially funded by Germans, and also funded by Russians. And so what was once this really heated scientific endeavor is now something that could only happen with international collaboration. But it does look like a Cold War facility in many ways. So I originally described the cyclotron that they used to slam these atoms together as being built in 1968. Mm-hmm. And he said that a cyclotron is like a Russian woman. You should never mention her age. But it is. It's a 1968 piece of equipment that they're doing the most sophisticated science in the world on. So it's a pretty amazing thing.
Well, Rob, so I want to ask you, what happens? I mean, after you create something like he's replicated a few times, this 114, 120, 126, what then happens? Does it have to go through a sort of jurying process to be named onto the periodic table?
Yeah, so there's a many-year jurying process. So 114 and 116 have both been through that process, and 114 ended up being named for Oganessian's advisor, Flerov. and 116 comes to be named for Lawrence Livermore Lab. And now we wait for the other new elements that they've found, but have not yet been officially accepted. So there will be more.
And that's Rob Dunn, a biologist and writer at North Carolina State University. You'll find a link to read his National Geographic article on element hunters at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. When you think about school science fair projects, maybe it calls to mind baking soda volcanoes or styrofoam models of the planets. More to the point, that's what a lot of students think of and what they enter in science fairs. But to a lot of real scientists, projects like that are missed opportunities. Rather than just building models, they believe children as young as 8 or 10 can do actual science and discover new things. Adam Hochberg reports.
When 14-year-old Kyle Gazzillo was getting ready for this year's school science fair in Dalton, Massachusetts, he had a pretty good idea what he wanted to enter.
I was hoping to combine inside a bottle baking soda and vinegar and seeing which ones explode the best.
Of course, it's easy to understand why teenagers gravitate toward projects that explode. Those baking soda rockets and baking soda volcanoes are old standards at science fairs, so popular that you'll find more than 100 videos on YouTube of kids making them. But the more Kyle thought about building effervescent bottle bombs, the less excited he became.
That's something a lot of people know how to do. It's just messy and looks cool. It has no science behind it besides the reaction with baking soda and vinegar or whatever you want to mix.
So by the time we met them at the Massachusetts State Science and Engineering Fair, Kyle and his research partner, Owen Alabozic, were showing off a very different experiment.
We did our project on standing and sitting and how it affects your memory.
Yeah, because when I study, I tend to like to stand, and maybe I was wondering if that affected people. And it did. Standing improved most people's memory.
That new project, one the eighth graders thought of themselves, earned third place in the state finals. And it's the kind of thing the fair's executive director, Cora Beth Abel, wants to see more of. Original research that relates to students' own lives, rather than demonstrations they copy from the internet or from books.
When students own their research, they care about it, and especially when it relates to the world around them. That student really gets excited and inspired in a way that reading a textbook just can't do.
The Massachusetts Fair has promoted that so-called inquiry-based science for years. But when it comes to the smaller fairs that local schools might hold, projects still often lean toward the familiar standbys.
When my daughter had a science fair, what she came home with was the idea to demonstrate something we already know.
That's North Carolina State University biologist Rob Dunn. He helps write a blog about bugs and microbes called Your Wildlife. Lately, he's been on a crusade to improve science fairs that started when his second-grade daughter showed him a list of suggested projects.
The standard sheet of paper had volcanoes. It had lots and lots of beans. You could do a collection of leaves. But what nobody was telling these kids is that even as second graders, they can do science that produces results to questions we don't know the answer to.
Dunn says most kids don't realize there are a lot of questions like that. So on their blog, Dunn and his colleague Holly Menninger asked readers to suggest projects that allow young people to do real science. They got more than 100 ideas.
So what do ants do when it rains? What do spiders in our house eat? What effect does the please pick up after your dog sign actually have on the removal of dog poop from a community?
Those projects focus on things kids see every day and could even yield some new information. But Menninger concedes they also involve something of a leap of faith, because unlike exploding bottles, original projects can have unpredictable results, or no useful results at all.
This happens to scientists all the time, too, that your hypothesis could have been wrong. And I think that's great. I think that sometimes some of the most exciting discoveries are the things that we don't anticipate.
But who wins a grand prize in a science fair with an experiment that doesn't come up with a result? We want something that goes boom or makes a lot of mold. Those are the ones that win the prizes.
I mean, that's a culture change, I think, sort of steering people away from the final product and focusing more on the process.
Menninger says a lot of kids are ready to do that. The bigger challenge is getting buy-in from adults.
I just have probably the shortest slideshow in the world, I hope.
At Western Carolina University, biology professor Kevin Catley manages a regional science fair and leads these workshops to prepare teachers for it. He says some adults make the fairs worse, parents who do the work for their children, or teachers who provide little guidance.
There's no question in my mind that 80% of the teachers that routinely do a science fair are not competent themselves, and this is no criticism, this is a critique of their educational experience because they've had no research background. So they find it very difficult to advise students, and the quality is pretty bad.
Catley says there's no quick fix for what he calls cookie-cutter science fairs. He says it will take better training for teachers and more support for science in general. But at fairs that have changed their culture, you can see the difference.
And next we have from Taunton High School, Olivia.
As the prizes were handed out at the Massachusetts Fair, the winners ranged from complex projects that studied topics like gene mutation to simple things like a student who found a way to make fluffier cupcakes. What the winners had in common is that they were fresh, scientifically sound, and potentially useful. And there wasn't a baking soda rocket among the bunch. I'm Adam Hochberg.
And that story came to us from Adam Hochberg as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PureX and made possible with funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at the potentially deadly art form of nitrate film with a report on the world's most dangerous film festival. Stick around for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hollywood blockbuster movies are shot in high-definition surround sound and 4K IMAX to create the most immersive viewing experience possible. Still, many film buffs said that nothing compares to the beauty and richness of a movie from the golden age of cinema in its original format, nitrocellulose, commonly referred to as nitrate. Chances are you've never seen a nitrate movie. There are only three theaters in the country licensed and equipped to project and screen them. For starters, nitrate film is prone to deterioration, and secondly, it is so flammable that the heat from a nearby cigarette can ignite it, creating flame so powerful it can continue to burn underwater. My guest John Lingen went to a festival of nitrate films. He's a freelancer who writes for the Virginia Quarterly Review, Deadspin, and others, including The Verge, which was where we found his article about the world's most dangerous film festival. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
What makes nitrate film so dangerous?
Well, as you mentioned, it is highly flammable. Nitrocellulose, which forms the base of this film stock, is actually a cousin to gun cotton or gunpowder. So we're talking, not only is it highly flammable, but is, you know, explosive upon igniting. And in addition to that, it can, as you mentioned in the intro, it doesn't take much for it to explode. In fact, in the 70s, I believe, the George Eastman House, who put on the event, this film festival, kept all of their nitrate film in an actual barn, and that barn exploded from overheating, and, you know, without even flame around, the film caught fire. So it's quite flammable and quite explosive when that happens.
When we were talking about it in our editorial meeting, I thought immediately of the film Cinema Paradiso, remember back in 1988. Is that what it was? The film
Absolutely.
Caught on fire? Same in Glorious Bastards, exploded.
Yes, absolutely. So those, it's not only has the nitrate itself been used as a motif in film history, as in those two movies where it explodes, but they've also, they used it as a special effect back when it was actually being used. They would, you know, ignite nitrate in order to create an explosion big enough for a scene that warranted it. That.
Wow. When did movie producers and theaters stop using nitrate film?
I think the best timetable says that they last used it to make movies in 1948. By that point, I think the risk of it had grown so great, and the replacements, you know, the replacement stock for it had grown easy enough to produce. They stopped using it and started using, I believe, polyester stock. I think it lasted probably in theaters until the earlier, maybe the mid-50s, but once it was replaced by that polyester stock that we refer to as safety film, it pretty much just went out of circulation altogether. And as you say, now there are only a few places in the country that even have nitrate projectors. And the Eastman House is the only one outside of Southern California.
Despite the dangers and difficulty of preserving it, many film buffs still consider nitrate film to be the absolute gold standard. So what is the difference between seeing a film shot in HD to seeing a film on nitrate?
Well, I mean, there are a couple things that people told me in the run-up to this festival. I spoke to a number of people who work as archivists and projectionists and, you know, are around nitrate film more often than most people. And everyone spoke of the sort of the richness of the colors. And they spoke particularly of the sort of depth to the blacks in the frame, so that when you look at the color, in particularly black and dark parts of the frame in a nitrate projection, it just feels and looks very sort of deep and rich and almost tactile. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of mystique around it.
Was all of the heralding of the nitrate film proved to be true?
I thought so. You know, I went there, as I think most people did. You know, I'm a longtime film buff and old movies in particular, classic movies. So I was going without really knowing what to expect. I was definitely looking for a big, I don't know, at least an experience to make my other film fan friends jealous. And I think what I found was way more than that, actually. I mean, the exciting thing about this festival was that it was not only an opportunity to see nitrate projected at all, but to see, I believe, 10 films from different countries, from different collections, from different genres, and from different decades as well. So it was an incredible sort of cross-section, and I have to say that over the course of the weekend and the course of these 10 movies, it was really just an incredible aesthetic experience. I mean, the richness of the color was there, but what surprised me more was how present everyone felt on screen. You know, the colors were, as I said, sort of eye-popping, but also, you know, you would notice textures of things, you know, like the carpet of a room in a scene, or the way a person's hair was combed, the leather of a suitcase, that kind of thing. It felt really three-dimensional in a way that I have not experienced, you know, with an HD film or with a digitally projected film. And I'm not, you know, a big card-carrying Luddite at all. Like, I don't look down on those formats or anything. But it was really special, you know, and it felt incredible to see these movies in the format where they were originally made, and to see that format was still an exciting thing to watch and an exciting, you know, format in its own way, not just sort of a way to talk about how, you know, great the greatness of bygone days or whatever else it might be.
John Lingen is with us. He's a freelance writer, and he attended the world's most dangerous film festival, a film festival in Rochester, New York, at the Eastman House, which houses the largest collection of nitrate films, which used to be the gold standard, but was deemed too dangerous and too hard to preserve. Well, then you did see several movies at this Nitrate Picture Show, which is what they call the festival at the George Eastman House in Rochester. Mm-hmm. What kind of safety precautions are in place there to both store and to project these films?
So the Eastman House, not only do they have the ability to project nitrate film, but they do it more or less year-round. I mean, only a couple times a year, typically, nothing like this festival until this year. But the projectors that they use and the sort of safety precautions that were in place are permanent parts of the Dryden Theater, their main exhibition theater there. So the projectors themselves date from the early 50s, and there's a whole sort of sequence safety measures in place at all times in the projection booth, including a sort of system of pulleys and wires running alongside the ceiling that in the event of an explosion or a fire of any kind, they sort of pull down like almost like a bus driver, and it snaps shut these two steel doors to prevent any fire from coming into the actual hall where people are seated and watching the movies. The projectors themselves, unlike typical film projectors made nowadays, each reel of film is contained inside its own metal box So it's sort of, as it spins and moves from one to the other, it essentially passes into a different metal box. And there's also, unlike in contemporary projectors, there's a little switch called a dowser that is meant to slam shut its own little metal gate in between the light, the heat source, and the film itself. So in the event that anything starts going haywire, they can just slam that shut immediately and hopefully prevent anything.
Wow. It feels like the Secret Service for film projection or something like that.
It takes a lot of specialized training and knowledge to do this, for sure. You asked also about how they keep the film stored. So just to show you again, like, how many precautions are taken. They don't even store their nitrate film in the Eastman house itself. They store it in a kind of white painted bunker about 10 miles outside of town in a more sort of rural area. They don't really advertise this location, but it's, reinforced concrete, kept at a near freezing temperature. Like, each roll of film is kept inside of a nickel plated aluminum canister, and then the canisters are kept in a refrigerated or in a series of refrigerated rooms that I think are kept about 40 degrees. There's all sorts of precautions about, how cold each room can be and how many fire extinguishers they're supposed to have on site and that kind of thing. So, yeah, they take it very seriously. I think with all those precautions, it's actually a relatively safe and stable medium, which is why they're able to pull a few of these films out from 70 and sometimes 80 years ago and project them, as normal, today.
Are many films still available in the original nitrate format?
Well, one of the reasons they had this festival was, in addition to sort of show it as a viable, film-going medium today, was also to really take stock of how many nitrate films are actually out there, because it's kind of unknown. Like, there are, there are libraries and film conservation societies all over the world that hold nitrate film, but there's not one sort of centralized database for people to keep in contact about it. So I believe the Eastman House holds somewhere in the realm of 20,000 to 25,000 nitrate films, and that includes shorts and Hollywood movies and, all sorts of things. And a number of those have deteriorated over the years and have shrank, as nitrate film naturally does, and are not in a position to be screened or exhibited. They can still be used for conservation and preservation purposes if they wanted to digitize them. So I think they keep 20 or 25,000 at least reels there, and then they invited different places from all over the world, including the Museum of Modern Art and Norway's National Library and a number of other places to essentially submit and send over what they thought was their best preserved nitrate film. And mm-hmm. The festival's program reflected that and included some films from all over the place. And many of the people who visited were representing either those countries or those collections. And so it was a really interesting sort of networking opportunity for people in this field to get together and I believe, to start a real ongoing dialogue about, what the worldwide collection of nitrate looks like and how it can best be preserved for future generations.
There is, in our digital age, many segments of the population that are reaching out for things that are more authentic, sort of things mm-hmm. the way that they used to be in a pre-digital era. Are you predicting any kind of nitrate revival, sort of like that going on for vinyl records?
Yeah, I think it would, it's never going to be even as big as the current vinyl resurgence, just because, anybody can buy a turntable and set it up for $100 in their house, whereas, like, the actual limitations on being able to see nitrate film projected are still really limited, and I don't believe anyone's going to be popping up anytime soon to be like a full-time nitrate revival house, because, it literally takes licenses and specialized equipment that hasn't been made for 60 years at least. But with that said, I think a revival of sorts could certainly take place. At the very least, there were a few hundred people in Rochester in early May to see this festival. And that's a few hundred people who most of us had never seen nitrate film projected. Very few people have. And so that event alone, you know, there are now a few hundred more people at least in the world and in all parts of the world who have now seen nitrate projected. And I believe it is the Eastman House's intention to do this as an annual event. And if that happens, if it becomes a sort of, you know, a destination weekend for people who love this kind of stuff and appreciate what it is, you know, that would hardly be the equivalent of you know, thousands upon thousands of vinyl records sold every year. But it would be a pretty massive change in film culture. I believe that. I mean, if more and more people are able to see this format and appreciate it as something more than just, you know, a myth, then I think that could really change what people appreciate about it and how people talk about it, absolutely.
Well, John, thank you very much for speaking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
John Lingen, he's a freelance writer. We found his article, A Weekend at the World's Most Dangerous Film Festival, at The Verge. You can read it yourself by going to our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a real-life story of finding a film treasure from the nitrate era in a southern New Hampshire barn. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we spoke with John Lingen about the beauty and danger of nitrate film and why those old films are worth preserving. But in the early days of film, no one thought about preservation. Reels upon reels were tossed into the trash or left to rot in attics and basements. Producer Tracy Mumford brings us the story of a New Hampshire man who stumbled upon a box of dangerous treasure left over from the golden age of cinema.
The hills of southern New Hampshire are a long way from the glitz and glamour of Hollywood. But that's where our tale of lost treasure begins. Our unlikely leading man is Peter Massey, a straight-talking, cigarette-smoking carpenter. In 2006, Peter was hired to clean out and tear down a one-horse barn built in the 1890s.
The homeowner had said that whatever's left in the barn goes into the dumpster. So, you know, we're Yankees, we were picking through stuff.
In the dust, he found seven old reels of film.
But they were just in a cardboard box or a couple cardboard boxes, sitting up in the hayloft.
And he saved them.
Because I wanted to know what was on them. I wanted to know what was there. Because I'm pretty smart like that.
Peter threw the box into the front seat of his pickup and drove off into the sunset to find someone who knew something about old films. Two towns over in Keene, New Hampshire, he found an expert. Dr. Larry Benequist, professor emeritus and founder of the film department at Keene State College. Larry gets a lot of calls about people finding old films.
In fact, it happened last week 3 times.
And he always takes them. He's helped identify and restore a dozen or more films previously thought lost.
It's like digging for skeletons or dinosaur bones in Africa. It really is.
And there's a lot to dig for. Much of America's early film history is lost.
80 to 90% of the ones made before 1930 are gone. And that's a lot of our cultural history. I mean, think about it. We have more surviving paper from the time of Shakespeare than we do film from the late 19th and early 20th century.
It's crazy to think about how much we're missing. Many films back then were only 10 or 20 minutes, so we're not talking about grand, sweeping epics. But these were artists experimenting with a brand new medium. And every film shows how American culture represented itself to itself at the turn of the 20th century. What we thought was beautiful, funny, heroic, and sad. What stories we thought were worth telling. Films from this era do occasionally turn up, though, and that's what gets Larry excited. He drove out to Peter's to see the reels. Peter was in the driveway, smoking a cigarette. Rule number one for old films, do not smoke around them. Films made before the 1950s are printed on nitrate film stock, which at a chemical level is very similar to gunpowder.
So it's a wonder I even made it here, because they were in the front seat of my pickup truck, and I was smoking cigarettes, and could have exploded. But anyway, Larry came over, and we looked at the films.
I thought, this is something different. I could even see, looking at it going by with a magnifying glass, somebody put some money and effort into this thing, whatever it is.
He wasn't sure what they had, but he knew it was something.
I said, Peter, you have to trust me with these films. I have to get them looked at.
Larry called in the reinforcements. Experts at the George Eastman Film Archive and technicians at Color Lab, which specializes in restoring old films. They cleaned and examined the reels and caught sight of a familiar face, Mary Pickford, America's first movie star. The movie on the reel turned out to be one of Pickford's melodramas from 1911. It's called Their First Misunderstanding, and it was the only copy left in the world. Mary Pickford rose to fame with silent movies, but that doesn't mean she was quiet. She ran the show like no one had done before her and no one has done since. She starred in 205 movies from 1909 to 1933. A journalist at the time wrote that she was the most known and most loved woman in the world in all history. She earned $10,000 a week at a time when the average American made only $750 a year. But she wasn't content to just stay in front of the camera. Crystal Schmidt, film historian and editor of Mary Pickford, Queen of the Movies, explains.
She is an actress, she was a producer, and she was also one of the co-founders of United Artists, which was Hollywood's first independent film distribution company.
She opened United Artists in 1919 with her husband Douglas Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin, and D.W. Griffith, director of Birth of a Nation. Opening her own distribution company meant that no one could tell her what to do.
So she could star in her own films, she could produce her own films, and then she could distribute her own films.
She was now in charge of every aspect, from script to screen. She made smash hit after smash hit through the 1920s, but her reign ended when film added sound.
Who is this perambulating?
She retired in 1933 and died in 1979. In the years since, many of her films have been lost and her fame has faded. But tonight, at Keene State College, she's back on the big screen. The film has been fully restored by the Library of Congress, and it's being shown for its first audience in nearly a century. A crowd of over 100 has gathered, film buffs and Keene State College students. They're screening it 1911 style, which means with live music.
I try to recreate that experience that audiences had that was why people first fell in love with the movies.
That's Jeff Rapsis on keyboard.
I kind of collaborate with dead people. I work with them as their movies get shown.
No one is more excited to see the film than Peter, who saved it from the barn.
Oh, I was wicked excited. I put on a suit. I usually wear Carhartts and a t-shirt, so I'm pretty excited.
Crystal takes the mic.
I'm going to warn you now that this is not in perfect condition. Considering this film was found in a barn, not in a can, and it's over 100 years old, how would you guys look, okay? Keep this in mind.
White splotches speckle the screen, but for the most part, the image is vivid. Pickford is acting opposite Owen Moore, her real-life husband at the time. On screen, they play happy young newlyweds about to encounter their first misunderstanding. It's actually a rather large misunderstanding. They go to a party and each thinks the other is falling in love with someone else. Mary's husband is so sure she's fallen for the piano-playing poet that he writes him a note telling him he can have her. When the poet comes to pick her up the next day, though, he's in for it. Mary pulls out her signature move. She beats him with a flower bouquet. When her husband returns that night, he finds Mary still at home, asleep in bed, waiting for him. She's decided to stay on her own terms. This film is an education for people who think early American cinema was a land of damsels in distress. Mary Pickford was not a lady who needed rescuing. She comes from an era when women could and did call the shots in Hollywood, both on screen and off. That's actually what drove Crystal to study Pickford in the first place.
She's a working class hero. She's a strong woman on and off screen. And I felt that people needed to be reminded of that because somehow we lost her and we needed to find her again.
And tonight we did. For Salt Radio, I'm Tracy Mumford.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, on iTunes, Word of Mouth, NHPR, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Please pass it around and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.